Ever found yourself wondering why that conversation with your boss went so awkwardly? Or why your perfectly reasonable request was met with resistance? Elizabeth Stoker's groundbreaking work, Talk, reveals that these moments aren't random. They follow predictable patterns that science can decode. As Malcolm Gladwell noted, Stoker's work represents one of the most significant advances in understanding human interaction in a generation. The book has become required reading in communication departments worldwide and has influenced training programs from emergency services to corporate boardrooms. Unlike typical self-help communication guides, Stoker's approach is grounded in rigorous scientific analysis of thousands of real conversations, making it the rare communication book that actually delivers on its promise to transform how we speak to one another. Talk isn't the chaotic mess it might appear to be. Unlike what linguist Noam Chomsky once described as a disorderly phenomenon, conversation follows remarkably predictable patterns, a conversational racetrack with clear lanes and rules. By studying real conversations in slow motion, we can see how different word choices lead to dramatically different outcomes, much like how different driving maneuvers affect a journey's course. The racetrack metaphor extends beyond simple turn-taking. Just as drivers must navigate turns, merges, and straightaway, speakers navigate through various conversational territories, from opening exchanges to closing remarks, from casual small talk to serious discussions. Each of these territories has its own unwritten rules and expected behaviors that competent conversationalists instinctively follow. Take something as simple as a greeting. When you answer the phone, you don't just say hello randomly. There's a three-part pattern: the summons slash answer, hello, identification slash recognition, hi, it's Elizabeth, and the how are you sequence. This pattern varies systematically by context. Doctor's appointments typically skip how are yous, business calls include formal identifications, and urgent calls bypass pleasantries entirely. Even cultural variations follow predictable patterns. Japanese telephone greetings often begin with moshi moshi, while Spanish speakers might start with diga. When these patterns break, it signals trouble, much like a car swerving out of its lane. Consider this call between Dana and Gordon. Gordon, hello? 0.7 seconds of silence. Dana, hello, where have you been all morning? That tiny 0.7-second delay before Dana responds speaks volumes. Rather than completing the expected greeting sequence, she immediately launches into a challenging question. Gordon responds with a bright, hello, followed by, strategically using his knowledge of conversational structure to push back against her confrontational opening. This interaction demonstrates how even microseconds of timing can carry significant meaning. These patterns extend to more complex interactions. Business meetings typically follow a predictable sequence: opening pleasantries, agenda review, discussion points, and action items. Even arguments have common structures: accusation, defense, counter-accusation, and either escalation or de-escalation. Understanding these patterns helps navigate difficult conversations more effectively. These aren't just academic observations, they're practical insights into how we navigate potential conflict. The conversational racetrack metaphor illustrates how speakers navigate interaction through different projects or actions that complete encounters. While some actions, like greetings and closings, are universal, others are context-specific: diagnoses, flirts, complaints. We may navigate smoothly like experienced drivers or bump along rumble strips when we mishandle turns. Despite popular psychology's focus on gender, culture, and personality, our behavior is profoundly shaped by the mechanics of conversation itself. By analyzing conversational patterns across contexts, from first dates to police interrogations, we can learn to use ordinary language resources more effectively. Understanding these patterns allows us to become more skilled conversationalists, better at reading social cues, and more adept at achieving our communicative goals. As natural conversationalists, we possess tacit knowledge about turn-taking and communication that we've developed since childhood. Yet despite this intuitive expertise, many common beliefs about talk are simply wrong. The science of conversation reveals that talk is simultaneously messy, with false starts and pauses, yet remarkably systematic, following predictable patterns that operate across cultures and contexts. Conversation operates on structured units called adjacency pairs, two turns that belong together, like question-answer or greeting-greeting. The first speaker produces a first pair part that creates an expectation for a specific second pair part response. These pairs are fundamental building blocks of conversation, appearing in contexts from casual chats to business negotiations. How quickly and appropriately this response comes shapes the interaction's meaning, with even microsecond delays carrying social significance. Scriptwriters intuitively understand these mechanisms, which is why we find certain dialogue exchanges humorous. Remember when Monica asks Phoebe and Friends, "You know what I'm thinking?" She's not actually seeking a guess, but using a turn designed to set up a future action. Phoebe's literal interpretation, attempting to guess, generates audience laughter because viewers recognize the violation of conversational norms. Similar examples appear in shows like Seinfeld, where characters frequently violate expected response patterns for comedic effect. Even film directors incorporate precise timing into their work, understanding that silence speaks volumes. In The Duchess and Frozen, characters hesitate before responding to yes-no questions, and these delays carry significant meaning, suggesting insincerity or reluctance rather than cognitive processing. That scriptwriters incorporate such precise timing, two-second delays, demonstrates the systematic, predictable nature of conversation that audiences intuitively recognize. This timing is so crucial that even a half-second deviation can change an audience's interpretation of a scene. Creating a successful invitation requires more than just asking someone directly. While a basic invitation sequence contains just two turns, the invitation and its acceptance, effective invitations often include preliminary pre-sequences. Asking, "What are you up to this evening?" before extending an invitation allows the speaker to test the waters and avoid potential rejection. This demonstrates how conversation operates on preference structures, not psychological preferences, but structural patterns where preferred responses, like acceptances, require less conversational effort than dispreferred ones, like rejections. These structures appear across languages and cultures, suggesting they're fundamental to human interaction. The science also reveals that interruption isn't just about overlapping talk. In collaborative conversations, simultaneous speech often shows cooperation rather than interruption, as when one friend helps another find a word after a brief hesitation. Research shows that up to 5% of casual conversation consists of cooperative overlap, where speakers build on each other's contributions. The organization of turn-taking reveals both systematic patterns and how participants negotiate their rights to speak, with subtle cues like breath intake, gesture, and gaze direction signaling speaking transitions. Modern conversation analysis has identified additional patterns, such as repair mechanisms for handling misunderstandings and the role of nonverbal cues in turn-taking. These findings have practical applications in fields ranging from artificial intelligence development to improving classroom discussions and medical consultations. How we speak fundamentally shapes who we are and how others perceive us. While psychologists often treat talk as merely a window to underlying personalities, our conversational choices actively construct our identities. The words we choose, like saying, "I had a fall" versus "I fell over," build our sense of self and form the evidence base for how others assess our character. Even subtle linguistic choices, such as using passive versus active voice or hedge-in phrases like "sort of" and "kind of," contribute to how others perceive our confidence, authority, and personality. First movers make unprovoked, out-of-place conversational turns that put others in difficult positions. Like Mr. R, who skipped normal greeting sequences to insult Leslie at a jumble sale, still trying to buy something for nothing, or Dana, who bypassed pleasantries to demand where Gordon had been all morning. These non sequitur openings create a trap. If the recipient calls out the inappropriate comment, the first mover can paint them as oversensitive. This pattern often appears in workplace dynamics where aggressive first moves can establish dominance while maintaining plausible deniability. We constantly judge people's character through their conversational choices. In Friends, Monica labels Danny rude when he responds to their apology with a brief "okay" before shutting the door. Similarly, in real conversations, Sophie complains about an ex who merely said hi and walked off, a greeting pattern acceptable for acquaintances but fucking rude for former partners. These judgments extend to professional settings, where brief email responses or delayed replies can lead to lasting character assessments. Speakers carefully monitor their own words, aware that what they say reflects on their character. When reporting racist language, people edit their speech to avoid appearing prejudiced themselves, often using phrases like the N-word or they used a slur rather than repeating offensive terms. Even in crisis negotiations, professionals analyze a person's turns to understand their character, like when negotiators discussing Mehdi interpret his communication style as characteristic of Arabic men. This self-monitoring extends to social media, where people craft personas through specific language choices and communication styles. The Conversational Analytic Personality Diagnostic identifies distinct personality types based on conversational patterns. Beyond first movers, there are misgreeters who fail at proper greetings, recalibrators who initially dismiss someone but suddenly become effusive when realizing the person's importance, how are you subverters who abuse the greeting ritual to launch into lengthy self-centered monologues, and non-transitioners who trap others in conversation by never providing cues for speaker transition. These patterns appear consistently across cultures, though their specific manifestations may vary. Recompleters hog conversational floor space by repeatedly finishing a turn that was already complete. They talk quickly past transition points where others might respond, then immediately restate their point in slightly different words, often using phrases like "and another thing" or "what I'm trying to say is." Passive-aggressive conversationalists maintain calm while provoking others to anger, then feign shock at the overreaction. A classic example is asking, "Why are you getting so upset?" when someone responds to their indirect hostility, or using phrases like "I'm just saying" to deflect responsibility. Provocative statements often appear in workplace dynamics. Our judgments about who people are fundamentally come from the turns they take in conversation. Though most of us aren't psychologists, we are all, consciously or not, conversation analysts, using people's words and actions as our evidence base for determining their character. These judgments form quickly and can be surprisingly durable, affecting relationships and reputations long after the initial interaction. Understanding these dynamics helps us navigate social situations more effectively and become more aware of how our own conversational choices shape others' perceptions of us. People often ask about common communication myths, particularly regarding body language versus verbal communication. This section examines whether popular beliefs about communication have any scientific basis and why so many myths about talk persist. The proverb "actions speak louder than words" dates to 1628 and exists across all major world languages, suggesting a universal belief that behavior reveals character better than speech. Related phrases like "talk is cheap" and "walk the walk" reinforce the idea that words lack substance compared to actions. However, discursive psychology emerged in the 1980s to treat language itself as action. Words do things, create speech acts, and have power. The belief that actions speak louder than words can actually hinder crucial conversations, as seen in crisis negotiations, where suicidal persons resist negotiators' requests to talk by invoking this very idiom. The widespread belief that communication is 93% body language is easily debunked. If this statistic were true, people wouldn't need to learn foreign languages, and we couldn't have meaningful phone conversations or radio broadcasts. The myth persists largely because presentation trainers and communication consultants continue to propagate it despite its lack of real-world application. In reality, we constantly monitor both words and embodied conduct together, interpreting meaning from their combination rather than treating one as more truthful than the other. The persistent belief that women and men talk differently is more cultural assumption than scientific fact. Though thousands of pop psychology books and scientific articles report gender differences in communication, research often begins with gender as a predetermined category rather than interrogating whether it's relevant. Claims about who talks more have yielded contradictory results. Some say women, others men, while some find no difference at all. The fundamental problem is that focusing solely on gender obscures more relevant factors affecting communication choices. Similarly, the assumption that all members of a culture communicate identically while differing completely from members of another culture ignores individual variation and complexity. When examining conversation across cultures, researchers find remarkable universals rather than stark differences. Recent research provides evidence for conversational universals across indigenous and major world languages, including similar turn-taking patterns with minimal overlap and silence between turns. Far from being meaningless fillers or speech errors, words like and serve precise interactional functions. When analyzed in context, these seemingly trivial linguistic features reveal speakers' real-time analysis of conversation. For instance, when Gordon responds to Dana's unexpected question about his whereabouts with hello, before answering, the signals he finds her question problematic. The persistence of myths about communication stems from a fundamental methodological problem. Most psychologists and communication scholars don't actually study real talk. Instead of examining live, unfolding conversation, researchers rely on experiments, self-reports, and simulations, often analyzing written text rather than authentic speech. Words matter profoundly in human interaction, as evidenced by how speakers constantly monitor and adjust their own word choices even mid-sentence. In one example, an MEP abruptly changes young ladies to young women when discussing workplace discrimination, despite the terms being near synonyms. In another example, a woman complaining about her neighbor's noise struggles to delicately describe hearing sexual activity using pauses, hesitations, and the phrase, "there's no delicate way of saying this," before settling on lovemaking. Word selection reveals how speakers constantly monitor and correct themselves, making both categorical errors, like saying sister instead of brother, and deliberate word swaps that carry social meaning. Beyond mere correction, word choice reveals how speakers position themselves and others. As when a speaker uses cops instead of police to sound cooler, or when selecting between different ways to refer to the same person, this man, Roger, Dr. Smith, based on recipient design and social context. Words don't just reflect our thinking, they actively shape outcomes in conversation. Like behavioral economists' nudge theory demonstrates how subtle language changes can guide behavior, conversation analysts study how different ways of formulating the same action produce different responses. A groundbreaking medical study examined how differently worded doctors' questions affected patient disclosure, showing that language choices function as a natural laboratory for studying human behavior change. The difference between using some versus any in questions dramatically affects responses. When doctors asked patients, "Is there anything else?" only 50% reported additional concerns, while "Is there some other issue?" yielded 90% disclosure. Similarly, in university tutorials and committee meetings, any questions typically receive minimal response, while some questions encourage participation. A conversation analysis study at an art gallery revealed how cashiers' question formatting dramatically influenced charitable giving. When asking customers about GiftAid, a UK scheme allowing organizations to reclaim tax on donations, cashiers who asked yes-no questions, "Would you like to giftaid.today?" were far more successful than those offering alternatives. "Would you like to GiftAid or just pay standard?" In crisis negotiations, every word matters. Analysis of police recordings revealed that when negotiators asked to talk with persons in crisis, it often led to resistance and rejection. However, when negotiators framed the proposed activity as speak rather than talk, persons in crisis engaged more readily. Unlike talk, the word speak doesn't carry negative idioms like all talk, no action, and doesn't open slots for resistance. Similarly, research with mediation services revealed that when mediators asked callers if they would be willing to participate in mediation, resistance transformed into acceptance. This approach works because it positions the caller as the reasonable party who is willing to resolve the dispute, implicitly contrasting them with their unreasonable neighbor. The word willing makes a moral proposition about the caller's character, opening a slot for them to confirm they're the good one. This section examines the intricate dynamics of how people use conversation to obtain help and service from others. While asking for help might seem straightforward, it involved complex social negotiations and linguistic strategies that go far beyond direct requests, as evidenced by common phrases like, "I hate to ask," "just ask," or "I don't want to be a bother." People frequently seek assistance through indirect methods, employing what linguists call pre-requests or phishing. In one detailed example, Marie begins by announcing she's sweating like a rapist and commenting that she's really hot, gradually building context before explicitly asking for deodorant. This indirect approach allows her to gauge willingness to help before making a direct request. Similarly, when Donnie describes his car being stalls in the parking lot, he carefully constructs the narrative without directly asking for help, creating multiple opportunities for Marcia to naturally offer assistance. These patterns appear across cultures and contexts, from workplace interactions to family dynamics. The opening moments of service encounters provide particularly rich insights into request strategies. Word choice and phrasing significantly reflect both the caller's perceived entitlement to service and their knowledge of the system. Modal verbs like "can I" or "could you" imply a certain level of entitlement, while more tentative phrases like "I was wondering if it's possible" or "I don't know if you can" deliberately reduce perceived entitlement. Medical appointment requests showcase these linguistic patterns clearly. Patients who ask for later appointments subtly categorize their needs as routine, while those who emphasize they need to be seen immediately signal urgency through their language choices. Even tone and pace can indicate the perceived legitimacy of the request. Service burden manifests particularly clearly in medical settings, where patients often must actively pursue service options. Multiple recorded examples show receptionists responding minimally to appointment requests, simply stating a doctor's unavailability without offering alternatives. When informed of a doctor's holiday, patients frequently need to make multiple attempts to prompt discussion of other options, rather than receptionists proactively offering solutions. Research conducted across multiple medical practices revealed that surgeries with higher patient burden consistently received lower satisfaction scores. However, implementing simple training programs teaching receptionists to actively offer alternatives and confirm appointments led to significant improvements in patient satisfaction without requiring additional resources. Service burden manifests particularly clearly in medical settings, where patients often must actively pursue service options. Multiple recorded examples show receptionists responding minimally to appointment requests, simply stating a doctor's unavailability without offering alternatives. When informed of a doctor's holiday, patients frequently need to make multiple attempts to prompt discussion of other options, rather than receptionists proactively offering solutions. Research conducted across multiple medical practices revealed that surgeries with higher patient burden consistently received lower satisfaction scores. However, implementing simple training programs teaching receptionists to actively offer alternatives and confirm appointments led to significant improvements in patient satisfaction without requiring additional resources. The relationship between recruiters, those seeking help, and the recruited, those responding to requests, appears consistently across various contexts, from splitting restaurant bills to managing workplace projects through email chains. This pattern connects directly to the broader concept of mental load, which is often gendered in heterosexual relationships. Research shows that women frequently carry the burden of remembering, planning, and managing household tasks, while their partners tend to only respond when explicitly asked. This creates an additional layer of invisible work beyond the tasks themselves, as the recruiter must constantly monitor, remember, and initiate action, while the recruited simply responds to direct requests. The final section offers five key strategies for more effective conversations based on scientific evidence rather than conventional wisdom. First, don't try to build rapport. Despite being pervasive in communication training, rapport is a nebulous concept that often backfires when forced. Using "how are yous" too early with strangers or failing to reciprocate them creates awkwardness. Names function as summons rather than rapport builders. They jolt people into attention rather than creating connection. When salespeople use customers' names unnaturally after brief pauses, it sounds calculated rather than genuine. The paradox is that deliberately trying to build rapport undermines what rapport actually is. It should emerge naturally through authentic interaction. Second, really listen. Effective listening goes beyond techniques like active listening or summarizing. It requires listening for both information and action, understanding what the speaker is doing with their words. Good listening means tracking not just what people say, but what they're trying to accomplish with their talk. Third, check your entitlement. Similar to check your privilege, this principle encourages examining how entitled you are to make requests. When asking for something, consider your entitlement to ask, whether you should do it yourself, the effort required from the other person, and the request's importance. Design your request accordingly to avoid being an unreasonable recruiter. Similarly, if you find yourself resentful about doing things for others, resist being recruited. Fourth, change one word. Remarkably, a single word can transform a conversation's outcome. Replacing "any" with "some" in questions about medical concerns shifts likely responses from "no" to "yes." Changing "interested" to "willing" regarding mediation participation increases positive responses. Using "speak" instead of "talk" with suicidal persons in crisis encourages communication. Words matter profoundly. Think about them and change them strategically. Finally, bust the myths. Replace talk myths with conversation science. Discard advice about being a good listener, building rapport, using body language, or talking differently to women versus men. Don't be a first mover. Consider your opening turn carefully and push back against others' first moves. Avoid being a misgreeter or recalibrator. Create conversational opportunities that open slots for positive interactions while closing those for conflict. The science of conversation remains relevant for years to come, even as technology advances. While conversation analysts are beginning to collaborate with computer scientists and neuroscientists to apply their insights to artificial systems, we're still far from enabling computers to talk like humans. Current natural language processing systems are only 80-90% accurate for words, and there are no algorithms yet for automatic conversation analysis. For now, the focus remains on humans talking to humans, with the science of conversation offering practical insights for improving our daily interactions.